The opposite of nukes is peace. Nuclear weapons are the ultimate, irrevocable embodiment of war. The only purpose they serve, other than the utter indiscriminate destruction of life on Earth at the push of a button, is the obscene enrichment of the empathy-less oligarchs who manufacture them. So what is one to do when another country moves its nuclear weapons onto an airbase in your country, literally next door to where you live, and takes over the entire base without ever asking your consent, let alone taking any time to get it, all so it can have a closer, better, faster shot at annihilating this week's chosen enemies? The only antidote to this ultimate threat to people and the planet is peace. But that raises the question, what exactly is peace? How do we learn about it? Who teaches it? How do we implement it? Where do we go to find others who agree with this concept? And what does it look like when they come together to fight for peace? It takes a genuine expert, a UK-based veteran peace campaigner with more than 50 years' experience, who sees clearly what has been going on at the Royal Air Force Station at Lakenheath in Suffolk, England. And she explains,
now they're bringing the US nuclear weapons back, and we've seen the construction going on and the bunkers made ready for them. And we don't know whether they're there yet or not, but it could be that they're there. And that's why we are organising this two-week international peace camp, actually, to have a 24/7 vigil every day for 2 weeks outside that base and to do various other things as well.
Well, when veteran British peace activist Angie Zelter provides not just the history of the activist fight against nukes in the UK, and she provides both history of what that protest movement has looked like in the past, but the upcoming International Peace Camp, which is meant to draw attention to the situation at Lakenheath and the growing protest against it. And when she does, you see that there are some people who have learned effective ways to fight back against that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who already know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevy. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we learn about next week's start of a 10-day peace camp outside the Lakenheath Royal Air Force Station in Suffolk, England. That's where the U.S. is staging nuclear weapons to put them much closer to their intended targets, and where local residents are having none of it. I talked with Angie Zelter, a veteran peace activist and campaigner, about the Lakenheath Peace Camp, what and why it is, and the response it is intending to spark in the fight against U.S. nukes on British soil. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Linda Pence-Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and more honest nuclear information than has yet received a tariff. But then I haven't checked the news this morning yet, and it's only a matter of time, eh? All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 8, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., on March 31st, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission's Atomic Safety and Licensing Board refused to grant a hearing on the merits for seven contentions brought by opponents of Holtec International's scheme to restart Palisades Atomic Reactor on the Lake Michigan shore in southwest Michigan. Terry Lodge of Toledo, Ohio, co-counsel of the intervening environmental coalition, said, "How is the concerned public supposed to take part in these life and death decisions? We consulted experts, drew from some 30 years' understanding of the weaknesses and troubled operating history of Palisades, offered targeted criticism of the dangerous short-sightedness of the restart, but in the end, the public is completely unwelcome to participate in this uncharted scam." The coalition opposing the restart includes Beyond Nuclear, Don't Waste Michigan, Michigan Safe Energy Future, Nuclear Energy Information Service of Chicago, and Three Mile Island Alert of Pennsylvania. The coalition's expert witnesses include Dr. Mark Z. Jacobson, environmental engineer, Stanford University professor, and world-renowned advocate for renewable energy, such as wind and solar power, as the most time and cost-effective way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in order to mitigate catastrophic climate change. But none of this was deemed acceptable to the nuclear agencies that are supposed to be protecting people and the environment. And as regards all these Holtec claims about small modular nuclear reactors, is this a Sputnik moment or a sputtering senior moment? Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
I don't know about you, but these days I feel like we are living in parallel universes, but both at the same time. There's the reality we know to be true, and then there's everything that's actually happening. For example, any school kid who knows how to use a pocket calculator could work out that small modular reactors are never going to happen because they are simply too expensive. Never mind too slow, too dangerous, and too waste-producing, for which you don't need a calculator, just common sense. That same kid could also tell you that even if we, the taxpayers, pay for them, and we will, small modular reactors still won't serve any useful purpose at all, other than to enrich a few CEOs. Like Chris Singh, for example. Singh is the CEO of Holtec, the company ostensibly in the nuclear reactor decommissioning business, but which has now positioned itself as a nuclear power plant inventor and operator, even though it has zero experience or track record in either. Thus, Singh was able to announce last month with a completely straight face that his company would not only restart and operate the decrepitly dangerous Palisades reactor in Michigan, it would build and operate two new small modular reactors on the site as well. Quote, "I call it a red letter day in the annals of commercial nuclear energy that I believe will be recognized as the day when new nuclear was born in the form of small modular reactors," said Singh at the announcement. Talk about chutzpah, but actually we're going to need a bigger word because chutzpah really doesn't cover this bombast nonsense. What Singh is going to find out is that the only red letters, or should I say numbers, involved in this fantasy will be those written in the ledger books if such a project ever launches. That debt will of course be passed on to us. As M.V. Ramana writes so perceptively in his must-read book, Nuclear is Not the Solution, that's the only reason corporations like Holtec are pursuing these nuclear fool's errands. Quote, "They only do so when the public can be made to bear a large fraction of the high costs of building nuclear plants and operating them, either in the form of higher power bills or the form of taxes. Then many companies find nuclear power attractive," Ramana writes. Quote, "Nuclear reactor vendors have one overwhelming goal, to persuade governments to force ratepayers and taxpayers to pay the high costs of nuclear reactors," he says. And so the preposterousness continues, with Amazon, Google, and Meta all clamoring that they are on board for efforts to at least triple nuclear energy worldwide by 2050. Perhaps they missed the memo, and actually the out loud pronouncements from the global banking community at the International Atomic Energy Agency's rah-rah nuclear energy summit in Brussels last March. European Investment Bank Vice President Thomas Ostros said of nuclear power investment prospects then, quote, "The project risks, as we have seen in reality, seem to be very high." Representatives from the European and Latin American banking worlds declared that Their lending priorities lean toward renewables and transmission grids, and that nuclear comes last. These are the big boys talking, the ones in long trousers who also know how to use pocket calculators and slightly more sophisticated financial forecasting tools as well. Nevertheless, executives from Amazon, Google, and Meta signed that same pledge so thoroughly dismissed at the Brussels summit. Their allegiance is, of course, not to the American people, let alone the planet, but to their own insatiable greed, which includes claiming they need small modular reactors to feed their power-hungry artificial intelligence data centers. But that aspiration got abruptly deep-sixed in January by China's DeepSeek, hailed as a Sputnik moment. DeepSeek, it transpired, could be up to 95% more energy efficient than, say, OpenAI, negating the argument for a needed nuclear expansion. The valuations of several nuclear firms duly plunged. So is this really a red letter day for new nuclear and small modular reactors, or more of a red flag? A Sputnik moment or a senior moment? A watershed or a Waterloo? Time may tell. But time, of course, is the one thing we don't have. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
In Colorado, nuclear power is officially a clean energy source, having been signed into law on Monday, March 31st. House Bill 1040 added nuclear energy to the state's list of clean energy resources, which consists of geothermal, solar, small hydroelectricity, wind, and hydrogen energy. It just tacks on the words "and nuclear" to the end of the list, paying no attention to nuclear's legacy of highly radioactive waste with no safe place to store it and no way to neutralize it, and the contamination that results at both ends of the fuel chains, from uranium mining and milling that takes place primarily on public and tribal lands in the West, to the aforementioned waste that happens at the other end of the fuel chain. By calling nuclear officially clean energy, one wonders if anyone in Colorado has ever bothered to check the definition of the word clean. Moving to Ukraine, nuclear authorities have sounded the alarm as Russia signals its plan to restart the Zaporizhia power plant, Europe's biggest nuclear site, sitting smack in the middle of a war zone. Petro Kotin, chief executive of Energoatom, which is Ukraine's state nuclear operator, warned that restarting the Zaporizhia nuclear plant under Russian occupation would be unsafe and practically impossible during wartime. He cited a lack of cooling water, a lack of trained personnel, and unreliable electricity supply as some of the most pressing safety issues, adding that restarting the plant safely would require full demilitarization and the withdrawal of Russian troops. If that happened, he said Ukraine could bring it back online within 2 months to 2 years, assuming a peacetime environment. But under current conditions, restarting even a single reactor would be impossible. Lots of hair-raising details in the article, and we will link to it on our website. This next story relates to our featured interview this week, as declassified Ministry of Defense documents in the UK reveal that U.S. visiting forces across Britain are exempt from nuclear safety rules. U.S. military bases across Britain are exempt from U.K. emergency radiation regulations, which means that bases like RAF Lakenheath, which is being prepared to host deadly new U.S. nuclear weapons, is under no legal obligation to have emergency radiation plans in place in case of nuclear accidents. This covers not only RAF Lakenheath and Suffolk, but all U.S. military bases across Britain. Following up on our interview last week with Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, news that the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission has authorized Ontario Power Generation to construct a boiling water reactor at the Darlington New Nuclear Project site in Clarington, Ontario. Dr. Edwards made the case last week that not only would Ontario be tied to the United States for parts, labor, and training for the new reactors, but it would be forever linked to the U.S. as the source for the nuclear fuel, which will put the province and thus the country at the mercy of the U.S. supply chain and possible tariffs. The Ukrainian-Canadian Congress is urging Canada to establish its own nuclear weapons program, arguing that the country needs to protect itself from both Russian aggression and potential threats from the United States. Bloomberg Canada ran an article with the headline, "Should Canada Explore Developing a Nuclear Weapons Program?" to which Nuclear Hot Seat answers, "No." We'll link to that article. In Germany, 700 tons of highly radioactive nuclear waste has reached that country from Sellafield in the UK. The waste is a result of reprocessing fuel elements from decommissioned German nuclear power plants at Sellafield, where, after melting it down, the resulting liquid is turned into glass, and that's how the waste is returned to Germany. Officials have sealed the port in Nordenham as the nuclear waste transport to Germany has triggered a number of protests by anti-atomic energy groups. And one more UK nuclear problem? Rats! Workers building the troubled Hinkley Point C nuclear reactor in Somerset have raised concerns that the construction site is overrun by rats. And unions have warned the developer, French energy giant EDF, that urgent action is needed because the rodents are everywhere. And the number of rats on the site is, quote, quite grim. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, numbnuts of the week.
A 12-year-old boy has built a nuclear fusion reactor in his bedroom, earning him a place in the Guinness Book of World Records for the youngest person to achieve fusion, and also a visit from the FBI, who said that they wanted to make sure that all was okay, while never bothering to define what okay would mean in this instance. The teen, Jackson Oswald, said, "I rebuilt the vacuum chamber, got a turbomolecular pump, sourced some deuterium for fuel, somewhat legally, and rebuilt the inner grid from tantalum," adding that he got almost every part from eBay. Doesn't that just make you feel great about nuclear security? And I've heard rumors that Elon Musk may be offering this prodigy a job with Doge. And that's why anyone who thinks it's a good idea that teenagers should be fooling around with nuclear fusion are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, numbnuts of the week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, I know you care about getting honest nuclear news, and that's what we set out to provide here at Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Verifiable, cutting-edge nuclear information that's been sourced, checked, and footnoted for accuracy, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you stories of brave people on the front lines of anti-nuclear activism around the world, their triumphs and challenges. We get underneath the manicured surface of mainstream media's nuclear stories to provide context and continuity, because we want you to understand what the issues are, what we are up against, and what any one of us can do about it. But to keep this show running, we need your support. Nuclear Hot Seat cannot survive without it. So if you're grateful for the information you get from this show and have ever thought that donating to Nuclear Hot Seat was a good idea, but you just haven't done it yet, the exact right time to start is now. We make it easy. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a red donate button you really can't miss. Or if you use Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 401c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. So please, don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate. And know that whatever you can do to help, you are making a difference to the show and to the world. And that, as always, I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. The U.S. is ramping up production of enough new nuclear weapons to blow Earth out of the solar system, and the country is spreading its nuclear presence around the world. One of the most contested locations where they're planning to install or have already started installing nuclear weapons is at Royal Air Force Station Lakenheath in Suffolk, England. Despite Lakenheath being a UK military base, currently it only hosts US Air Force units and military personnel, and maybe, already, some nuclear weapons. To learn more and find out what is being done to fight against it, I spoke to Angie Zelter. She is a British activist and founder of a number of international campaign groups, including Trident Plowshares and the International Women's Peace Service. Zelter is known for nonviolent direct action campaigns and has been arrested more than 100 times in Belgium, Canada, England, Malaysia, Norway, Poland, and Scotland, serving 16 prison sentences for her beliefs. Angie is a member of the Lakenheath Alliance for Peace, a coalition of groups that is dedicated to preventing the return of U.S. nuclear weapons to the RAF base at Lakenheath. She is also one of the organizers of the Lakenheath Peace Camp, which starts next Monday, April 14, 2025, and runs through the 26th. This 10-day event is cast in the image of the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp, which ran for 20 years from 1981 to 2000 to protest against nuclear weapons being placed at RAF Greenham Common in Berkshire, England. It was ultimately successful in having the nuclear weapons removed, and that's what they're aiming for now at Lakenheath. To learn more about this latest peace camp, what it is, why it is, who's involved, and what its organizers hope to accomplish, I spoke with Angie Zelter on Monday, March 31st, 2025. Angie Zelter, thanks so much for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's my pleasure. It's great to talk to you.
First of all, give us a little sense of who you are and some of the actions you've been involved in the past.
Well, I'm a long-time peace and environmental human rights campaigner. So I've been campaigning for 50 years now, I guess it is almost. I'm 73. I'm now living in Wales. But I used to live in North Norfolk, where there were a load of US nuclear bases and US bases that were so horrendous that we used to call it Britain, the US aircraft carrier for the US, so the US aircraft carrier. So I started really off at Greenham Common, started doing actions at Greenham, and my first arrests were there and at the House of Commons protesting about nuclear weapons. But it soon evolved into trying to stop logging in ancient rainforests, trying to stop the genocide in East Timor, involving a plowshares action where we took out non-violently a plane that was going to go out to Suharto's East Timor where genocide was being committed. And then another major action was when we took out an essential link of the UK nuclear weapon system. So basically, I've been organising civil resistance programmes. But I also went to set up a project called International Women's Peace Service in Palestine, because I've got Jewish relatives in Israel and was visiting there and wanted to know more about the whole history. My father-in-law is Jewish. He never wanted to go to Israel because he said that it should never have been taken away from the Palestinians. So that is an ongoing issue that I've been interested in too. So lots and lots of different things I've been involved with.
So it sounds like you're a long-term warrior on behalf of people on the planet and perhaps a bit of sanity in there as well.
Yeah, but there are a lot of us around, actually. You wouldn't know about it from the way the press don't cover it, but there are millions of us probably trying to create a better, more compassionate world.
There's very little coverage of what is being done to oppose nuclear anything in Europe. It doesn't get through mainstream media. Nuclear Hot Seat is a major channel for that. Now, first, you mentioned the Greenham Women's Common. We don't know about that here, so explain a little bit about that.
Well, we did actually have quite a lot of Americans coming over. So, you know, some people did know about it. It was a massive movement, feminist movement, of women surrounding a base that was going to host US cruise missiles. And that protest went on for about 20 years and it was finally closed down. And that has now been, the base has been taken away and it's now common land, which is what it was originally. So that was where a lot of people, I mean, I was quite young at that time. I had young children, but a lot of women from all sorts of different backgrounds, different nationalities came together, camped around the base. And they just kept going into the base, leafleting, doing blockades. There was a surround the base with, I think, 20,000. I can't remember how many thousands of women. And it was a massive campaign and it got loads of publicity. And it was very, very effective. And women learned to speak up for themselves and to protest in any way in which they felt was right.
What years, when you say it was the 20-year period of time, which is extraordinary in and of itself, what years was that and how long ago did it end?
My memory for dates is absolutely horrendous, but it would have been in the early 80s.
So what we're talking about is more than 40 years since then, which is why there's at least a generation and a half or two generations who don't know about this. Now, there are currently plans for a revival of this sort of activism. I know you're involved with it. Tell us what that is about.
Well, there's a revival of all kinds of activism, actually. It's not just anti-militarist, anti-nuclear stuff, but it's also about climate change. And I have to say in an ashamed manner that Britain probably has more young activists in prison on long sentences than anywhere else in Europe. The nuclear issue has come up a lot recently because of the threats Putin made to use nuclear weapons. But of course, it's always there as a threat. So people are very worried. And then, of course, what happened is that a lot of activists, and I was part of a group called the Lake and Heath Action Group. Lake and Heath, by the way, is an RAF base, but basically Lake and Heath is a US base. It's the largest in Europe with almost 11,000 US personnel. It's right next door to Mildenhall, which is another US base, and that is in East Anglia, in the eastern side of the UK. Now, about 17 years ago, we managed to, not just us doing the campaign, but we did manage to get rid of all the US nuclear weapons. They all went. But recently, we've been told that we're going to have these US nuclear weapons coming back to Lake and Heath and all of the European bases, the US bases in Europe, have been told to show that they've got nuclear weapons, as if our so-called enemies don't know where they all are, okay? So basically, we've got fighter bomber planes that are based in Lake and Heath. They're F-15Es and F-35As, and they can be identified by big LA on the tail fin. And both can be used for ground attack or in air combat. And they've been used in conventional wars, okay, for a very long time. Horrendous stuff. And in fact, just after the Hamas attack on the 7th of October in 2023, F-15Es from that Lake and Heath base landed at Muwaffaq Salty Air Base, which is in Jordan. It's a US, major US base in Jordan. And that was to bolster the US presence in the region. Since then, it's been providing ongoing support to Israel in its military attacks on Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. So there is a problem with the US base there anyway, with conventional weapons, which is horrendous. They've been involved in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Yemen, in East Africa, the Middle East. So that's a problem. But now they're bringing the US nuclear weapons back to go on to those aeroplanes, those fighter jets. And we've seen the construction going on and the bunkers made ready for them. And we don't know whether they're there yet or not, but it could be that they're there. And that's why we are organizing this 2-week international peace camp, actually, to have a 24/7 vigil every day for 2 weeks outside that base and to do various other things as well.
Who is behind the organizing of this 2-week peace camp? When are you aiming for it to happen? And give a shout out. Let us know how we can participate.
Well, there's 58 different organizations that have signed up to be part of the alliance. Most of them are in the UK, but there are a few, I think, from the US. There's a lot from Europe, there's some from Japan and South Korea. And it's an international peace camp that will go on from the 14th of April to the 26th of April, so not very far away now. And we're organizing an international peace conference. Now, usually peace conferences attract people who already know about these things and they're networking together, which is very important, but they're usually in big centers. And we decided we would have it right next door to Mildenhall and Lakenheath in a village hall, and we'll be leafleting local people and encouraging them to come and hear all these internationals who are fighting in their own areas. Mostly in Europe, but some in Japan and South Korea, and what they're doing and why they're against these US bases and what impact that has on local communities having these military bases there, over which we've got no control. It's totally undemocratic. You know, if the US decides to use nuclear weapons from a base like Lakenheath, it can do that. We've got no say in it, and we weren't ever asked whether we wanted that as a public. It's our government in cahoots with whoever is in power at any time in the US who decide to do this. And it's an existential threat. And at the moment, we have too many existential threats. We've got climate change, biodiversity loss, nuclear weapons. You know, we should all be working together, sharing stuff equally and creating a decent world where everybody gets what they need, and we don't have these big corporations and corrupt governments exploiting the natural resources of other countries for their own interests. It's got nothing to do with self-defense, nothing to do with self-defense. It's all about gaining resources, strategic advantages, and they need enemies. And one of the worst things is, and I'm sure most of the people who listen to you know about this, is the arms trade. It just makes huge amounts of money, and they want these wars. They don't care who they sell the weapons to, they sell them to both sides sometimes. So that is something, inequalities that are going on. We have to change all this. It's destroying it at us.
What kind of programs are planned or envisioned for this 2-week period international gathering that's going to take place?
First of all, we will be having a vigil actually at the main gate where people, local people can come, anybody can come. So throughout 24/7 throughout the 2 weeks, so night and day. And there will be all of the banners will go up there, and people will be beside a very, very busy road. So last time when we did it in July, when we've only been going a year, but we did a small camp about 10 days. And we walked from Norwich over 4 days to Lakenheath, then set up this camp. And we had a lot of passers-by on that main road who hooted for fun, you know, and a support. So that was very good. So that will be at the base. And then at the campsite, which is a little bit further away, we'll have a lot of different workshops. And then throughout the 2 weeks, we'll have various event days. So, for instance, we've got political choirs and singers coming along one day, and they will be singing anti-war, anti-militarist songs at the main base, at the main gate, but then also doing that and leafleting in the villages and towns nearby. Then we've got a climate day, making the links between war causes climate change causes war. There will be a faith day for interfaith people, Muslims, Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Sikhs, coming together to pray and create a very loving and peaceful environment there and have their services and prayers there. There will be a war crimes and genocide day when we will be talking about the horrendous war crimes and genocides that are going on, not just in Gaza, but in Sudan, in Myanmar, in all sorts of different places, and the war crimes. And we will be reading a letter and maybe sending it over in paper planes so that the servicemen can hear it, was an indictment of the war crimes and the international humanitarian law that is being broken by the people in that base. And then we will finish with a big blockade on the 26th. So it's a very busy schedule.
I assume the blockade is intended to have at least certain representatives arrested.
We don't intend to arrest. All we want to do is to stop what's going on there. And also, we have been asking to meet with the base commanders, two US base commanders and an RAF commander, since we started a year ago. And we've been giving letters in and we've had absolutely no response at all.
What about the media? Has there been any advance interest in putting out the word about this or covering it, including your perspective, if not from your perspective?
Well, let's start with our walk in July and the camp there. We got a lot of very good local coverage, okay? Not very much national coverage, but a lot of very good local coverage, which was excellent. And it was very positive, actually, especially because there were quite a lot of older Greenham women there who were saying, you know, we're going to have a success here like we did in getting rid of cruise missiles in the 80s. So that was great. Now, this time, because we've got a lot of internationals coming, some of whom, oh, well, one of them includes Colonel Anne Wright, who used to be, I don't know if you know about her. She resigned over, I think it was over Afghanistan and what was going on there. And she was part of the US Army. Well, she's coming over. And there's various other people from other places who are really, really quite well known in their own countries. So we're hoping to get a lot more media coverage there. So there is already some interest. There'll also be a videographer who will be there for the whole 2 weeks taking video footage, and that will be made into a long film. We had a short film made of our July action, walk and action. You can see that on our website. But this one will be obviously much, much more important and a larger, longer film.
You mentioned the Greenham Women's Common. Is this event specifically geared towards women, or any gender identification can attend?
Our particular camp, Lake and Heath Alliance for Peace, is for anybody and everybody, as long as they're nonviolent and they sign up to our nonviolent guidelines. And we also have a well-being policy that everybody needs to treat everybody else with respect. So everybody's welcome, all ages and all genders and sexes, no problem.
Is this something that you envision going forward? Meaning in future years, you will have other events of this sort happening until the problem is done away with?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when things like this happen, you have to have a continual resistance. Okay. Now, obviously, since we did the July camp, the local people, mainly local people, with a little bit of support maybe from outlying areas in the UK, have been continuing to do a vigil once a month on the last Saturday of every month. So that sort of kept it going. It also kept us keeping up with the, we always do police liaison. So we've been liaising with the Suffolk police about that. We don't liaise with the Americans. We liaise with the Suffolk police because they're the ones that are really meant to be, you know, looking after us. The American police and the Americans inside the base seem to think that if you go over this white line, you're in American territory. And I must say, as British citizens, we don't find that a very, we don't enjoy hearing that if you go over there, you're now in American territory. You know, it's like this is in Britain. And it should be honestly called a USAF base, but they still pretend it's an RAF base. There is one RAF commander there. Hardly any British soldiers or anything there. It's all American personnel there. And he has absolutely no power at all.
So this camp is going to take place April 14 to 26, which is very short notice if somebody wants to jump on. If there is the possibility of becoming part of this in the future, or people wish to explore this or get on a mailing list, whatever, where do they go and what do they need to do?
They just go to our Lake and Heath Alliance for Peace website. That's just lakeandheathallianceforpeace.org. And loads of information is on there. And if they send an email to info@lakeandheathallianceforpeace, and I can give you that information again later on, they can contact us and get our information. We have social media as well, so they can listen to the social media. Different. That's all on the website. So it's a very good website. It's got a lot of stuff in there about Lake and Heath and Mildenhall, what they've been up to and what we're doing and our programme. So you can get lots and lots of information. If somebody wants to send a kind of statement of support in to us because they can't come, then we'll put that up on the website and on the social media, especially if they, you know, they're doing similar kinds of work in the States and they want to make a connection. Because I think at the moment, With the world being as it is, the majority of people around the world all want the same thing. They all want the same thing. They want a livable planet where we're all living equally and in just conditions. You know, they want us to be dealing with climate change and replanting things so that we've got a living ecosystem instead of having militarization destroying everything the whole time. So the majority of people, whatever country they're in, there's no enemies out there. There are countries that our states think of as enemies, and therefore nothing ever kind of gets done, but the people are the same. And so now we need these solidarity movements to join us all together rather than thinking that we're all enemies.
Would that I could jump on a jet and be with you for this, but perhaps the one after that, with enough advanced planning, I'll be able to get there, because this is the kind of action and inspiration and spark that we need here in the United States, because we've already seen the politicians aren't going to do anything except cover their own posteriors. So what we need to do is put more of a fire under those posteriors so that something gets done. But meanwhile, you and your group and your actions, this is an inspiration. This is a beacon of hope. Because as you come together, and if and as you can grow this, especially over the 2 weeks that you're there, it will be a model, a beacon, an inspiration, and a roadmap to what we can do elsewhere.
Yeah, it's really, really important in these times, because a lot of people here, as well as in the States, but I have a lot of American friends, obviously, they're just feeling hopeless, depressed. They feel that there's nothing they can do, that it's totally out of order, and what can they do? But actually, we keep our hope alive. We can together change things.
I studied spiritual psychology and I have my master's degree in it. And one of the things that we learned is that the way to get out of depression is to take action.
Absolutely.
So I hope that this at least inspires a few other people to take action. And from a distance, I support you, I cheer you on, and whatever I can do to help you in the future, I will definitely be available to do so.
Okay.
Angie Zelter, thank you for the work you have done for so many decades. Thank you for the inspiration and articulateness that you bring to this entire movement. Because this is movement now. It's not aspiration. We're actually doing it. And for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
That was Angie Zelter, veteran peace activist and one of the organizers of the Lake and Heath Peace Camp, taking place April 14th to 26th, 2025, outside the Royal Air Force Lake and Heath Station. And this is in protest of U.S. nuclear weapons that are either there already or are scheduled to be there on English soil. For people in the United States or any other country where you're listening to this show, if you want to get involved or send them a statement of support that gets to the Lake and Heath Peace Camp, you can write to info@lakeandheathallianceforpeace.org.uk. And to help you get and stay motivated, we'll also have a link to Angie Zelter's book, Activism for Life, a whistle-stop tour of the last 45 years of nonviolent direct action in the UK and abroad. It's available through Goodreads, and we will have that link up on the website as well. A few additional points. The official name of the event that is a model for the Lake and Heath Peace Camp has the official title of Greenham Common Women's Camp. It may have gotten muddled with linguistic dyslexia a few times in the course of the interview. And we have a second featured interview this week. March 28 marked the 46th anniversary of the nuclear meltdown at the Unit 2 reactor at Three Mile Island in Middletown, near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I always like to include historical material from that time during the anniversary period. The timing didn't work out for last week's show, so I'm happy to, this week, be able to present my interview with Mary Stamos, who is also known as Mary Osborne. She was a longtime Middletown resident, a Three Mile Island survivor, and a member of Three Mile Island Alert. Mary, who had no previous history as an activist, became involved in issues immediately after the accident when she noticed plant mutations, known as fasciation, that can be traced to radiation exposure. Her collection of mutated plants and flowers from the area was accepted by the Smithsonian Institution in 2019 to be preserved, digitized, and made available to the public. For this interview, we spoke at the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island accident from March 26, 2019. Here, she fills us in on how she learned about the radiation releases from Three Mile Island on the third day after the accident.
The next morning, around 8:30 or 9:30, all of a sudden, I heard sirens ringing and the church bells were ringing, which I never heard like this. And all of the sirens were ringing in this area. And I turned the TV on. I didn't see anything. Then I turned my radio on, and I hear the newscaster, Ron Drake, talking about having uncontrolled radiation releases from Three Mile Island. And that's when I really started to panic. And a little bit later, the one person, I don't know who it was, that we consider him a hero, he turned the sirens on in Harrisburg, and the people started to panic, and they were hearing all the news about what was happening. And then the governor, Thornburg, was kind of forced into talking about radiation, you know, and the exposure that people might be getting.
Governor Thornburg.
Based on advice of the chairman of the NRC, and in the interest of taking every precaution, I am advising those who may be particularly susceptible to the effects of any radiation, that is, pregnant women and preschool-aged children, to leave the area within a five-mile radius of the Three Mile Island facility until further notice.
And like I said, I'm 6.5 miles away, but I was still worried.
The whole idea of being able to evacuate the communities that size is absurd. It's been absurd all along, and it's just governmental and utility nonsense to talk about being able to cope with a situation by evacuation, because you're never going to get the people out.
Alone in a house without a TV and with no radio on, I knew nothing of the panic and the chaos around me, and instead sat and continued writing on my musical, coincidentally entitled Armageddon. That is, until I heard an announcement come down the street, and in order to try to understand it, ran downstairs and opened the front door to hear the full announcement included the information: stay indoors, keep your doors and windows closed, do not go outside unless you absolutely have to. Here's why, as it finally came across in the media.
It began at 6:40 this morning and lasted until 9 o'clock. Another unexpected and substantial release of radiation into the atmosphere from reactor number 2. It produced a huge cloud of radioactive xenon gas and radiation levels 10 times the amount considered safe for the general public to be exposed to in a full year.
The new information is this. The accident sent ionized radiation beaming through the plant's 4-foot-thick walls. Consequently, the metal shield that protects the nuclear fuel may have been damaged.
Suddenly, everything I had been made afraid of during the Cold War as coming from the Russians was threatening my life from just 1 mile away, courtesy my own government and the local utility.
I had no means of transportation, knew nobody in the area except my friends who were at work, and even the house I was staying in had no basement in which to hide from the radiation. For all I knew, the radiation level was so high that, in essence, I was already dead.
Outside Three Mile Island, all was bedlam.
It's like your house is on fire, and you only have so many minutes to think, and you don't know which to grab first, and you don't know what to do, and you don't know where to go, and if you do go, you have to go with the idea that you're never coming back. Now, it's one hell of a horrible experience.
People were concerned. You could tell that they were afraid, because a lot of people left town, left their doors wide open, unlocked, just put anything in a car and take off. They had a run on a bank. People needed money to go where they were going, and it was just a mess.
The children left in school were not immune to the trauma.
The schools were in a panic, the kids. A lot of them thought about dying, and they had written their last wills and testament, you know, fifth grade, sixth grade kids.
The reporters who had swarmed to Three Mile Island to capture the story and were not immune to its long-term consequences
often betrayed their own nervousness.
Yeah, a lot of people are leaving the Harrisburg area right now. My own family's on the way to New York City right now to stay with relatives. A lot of people, the gas stations are flooded. The banks were busy. People were withdrawing some of their money so they could get out of here.
I didn't have a car that morning, so I talked to my neighbor, and she said that we could go to her mother's house. So I got my son ready. I went to school to get my daughter out of school. And her teacher was really upset because she had children that she couldn't go get until all her children from the school were leaving. So when we got to the school, got my daughter, and then we went to my friend's mother's home. That was about 10 miles. And then my husband was still out of town. He worked at a telephone company, and when he tried to call, he couldn't even get through. The phone lines were so jammed.
I had the exact same problem trying to call out. There was this weird siren sound on the line that wouldn't let me get through.
Oh, wow.
My friends finally did get through to me on the phone, which had been jammed with no lines available. They picked me up, and we evacuated to friends of theirs who lived 150 miles away, which we hoped was far enough. I stayed there for the next 10 days and then flew out, away from Harrisburg, away from Middletown, and Three Mile Island. So I missed having a community of people who, together, were able to process, commiserate, and get angry, much of it in a legal way, at the powers that be at Three Mile Island. But I also missed the worst of the follow-up information. Mary Stamos.
When I got my daughter ready to go back to school the one morning, I was brushing her hair, and she had thick, lovely hair, blondish, and a whole lot of hair came out in the hairbrush, and it kind of freaked me out. I gave my son a little bath, and I saw a whole wad of hair in the tub, which I never had experienced before. And when I looked at his scalp, I could see his scalp, and it wasn't solid hair. And I didn't think a whole lot of it because I thought when radiation caused hair fall out, I thought you would be bald. I didn't know until a couple of years later that you could just have a certain degree of hair loss. I didn't know what was going to happen to us in the future if we'd all get cancer or whatever.
Other problems noticed and documented by Mary Stamos in the immediate aftermath of Three Mile Island include a sudden growth spurt in some of her plants, as much as 4 inches in less than a week. Mutated flowers, branching out into multiples that did not previously exist in nature. A rose that grew out of the middle of another rose, but with no reproductive components visible on either of them. And dandelion leaves that were 3 feet long. These are all evidence of a process known as fasciation, which are mutations in plant life following exposure to radiation. Fasciation has also been observed at Fukushima and Chernobyl. Changes in animal birth and development were also noted in the first year after Three Mile Island.
The cats and the ducks seem to be the most vulnerable, and that's possible that this is occurring because you have a higher reproductive rate. It's faster, the turnover is faster. You know, they live in an environment, hunt in an environment, feed off the environment, they bathe themselves, so if there's anything there, it's going to show. Okay, what we encounter is we have at least 3 male toms right now that will not breed. They're old enough to breed. Evidently, they're sterile. They won't breed at all. And we encounter a lot of miscarriages in the cats. You know, they swell up, look like they're pregnant, and then there's nothing. The litters are very small now, anywhere from 1 to 4 is most you'll see in a litter anymore. And usually litters that run at least 6, but the most we're getting is 4, and the kittens are very small. And the development stage is so slow, it's unbelievable.
Animal mutations and animal deaths followed.
There was a lady at one of the first meetings I ever attended, the public NRC meeting. She stood up and asked a question of the NRC or MedEd, the Metropolitan Edison, the TMI owners. And she wanted to know when they were going to pay her for her losses of animals. And she had a dog kennel or a poodle kennel. And her poodles was born with no eyes. It had eye sockets but no eyes, and she lived right down across the street from Three Mile Island. They paid her every penny that she asked for, but she was not allowed to talk about it.
Mary Stamos, also known as Mary Osborne, had much more to say about this, and you can hear her in my archival compilation of clips from the time that the accident was actually happening. It's on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under episode number 509 from March 23rd, 2021. Mary Stamos, also known as Mary Osborne, passed away on February 14, 2024. But her legacy continues not just in the recording she made here for Nuclear Hot Seat and in so many other places, but at the Smithsonian Institution.
Activists, shout out.
There's an interesting Zoominar coming up that is a follow-up to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons meetings in New York City at the United Nations. Presenting will be Mary Olson, the founder and head of Gender and Radiation Impact Project, Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear, and Dr. Amanda Nichols of UCSB. All three of these women attended the meeting of states parties. They presented material. And because their presentations were not recorded, because none of them were at the United Nations, they're presenting much of their information along with the Q&A so that you can join in. The three presenters are Dr. Amanda Nichols of UC Santa Barbara, Mary Olson, the founder and head of Gender and Radiation Impact Project, and Cindy Folkers, the radiation and health hazard specialist for Beyond Nuclear. Mary and Amanda will be presenting from a new report that they co-authored, Gender and Ionizing Radiation, a New Research Agenda Addressing Disproportionate Harm. This webinar is free, but you must be registered ahead of time in order to attend. And we'll have a link up to that on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 719. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 8th, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way for you to never miss a single episode. You can sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel or cut to the chase and help me out with Google. Go to NuclearHotSeat.com. The yellow opt-in box is right there. You can't miss it. Put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one, just one, I don't bug you, one email with the link to that week's show and a short description of its content. Fashioned email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Always and constantly. Anything helps, and we will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as Allison McFarlane, former chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, said, a nuclear accident anywhere is a nuclear accident everywhere. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.